Before I get started this week, I wanted to make sure that I gave a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a stress and TMS coach based in Los Angeles. Her work involves not only a specialized focus on TMS, but also helping clients transform important aspects of life that feel stuck or overwhelming, such as career, relationships, weight issues, confidence, purpose, life stressors, you name it. So the results are twofold. One, you'll finally heal those TMS symptoms. And two, you'll take control of other areas of your life that need your attention and care. Perhaps you've only experienced small improvements with your TMS symptoms, or perhaps you're overwhelmed with whatever the next steps could be. Either way, many clients come to her who have tried traditional therapy, group coaching, or various other programs and made only minimal improvements. Jeannie will help you find the healing that's been elusive. I encourage you to book a free introductory call to learn more about her one-on-one coaching program, which includes weekly calls and consistent support between sessions that helps you get over the hump to your goals. Go to jeanniecolwin.com, that's JeannieColwin.com, to book your free call, and also check out the testimonials page to see her clients' transformations firsthand. Thank you so much for dropping by the podcast. It is Thursday, December the 14th, winding down in the last couple of weeks here of 2023. If you're interested in supporting the show, go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Throw a couple bucks in the tip jar. It would greatly be appreciated. So this week, a little bit of a different angle, having a clinical psychologist with a specialization in sport. It's taken forever for him and I to get together for this, but I'm very happy that we finally did. Michael Soleil from San Diego, he's a clinical psychologist specializing in sport. We talk a lot in here, everything from coaching youth athletics to something called identity foreclosure, performance anxiety, a variety of different things, not necessarily specifically in the TMS realm, though we do touch on that at different parts throughout this podcast. I'm very excited for you to hear Michael and I. Let's not waste any more time. Let's check out Michael Soleil and I from San Diego, clinical psychologist with a specialty in sport. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. I'm very excited today. It's the first person in this line of work that I've had on the show before. Clinical psychologist with a specialty in sport, Michael Soleil from San Diego. Are you here and can you hear me?
I am here and I can hear you.
It's great having
Thanks
you
for
here.
Having me.
Yeah. It's great having you here. You're on the best coast, as I always tell anybody. It's interesting. I don't know if there's like a nucleus of people that understand or are in this sort of field, meaning like TMS, mind body, emotional issues, stuff like that. Jim Prusak, and there's been all sorts of people from San Diego. That I guess it's a big town, and maybe that's more what it is than anything. A lot of experts there. So I told you before I hit record that I'd kind of give some context on why this is so fascinating to me. In 2017, I had been quite a long time into this odyssey of chronic health problems, and I went to see a doctor at the University of Washington. She was the head physician, and still is, for the University of Washington men's football team. And she did this entire clinical analysis and strength tests and all this kind of stuff, had my imaging that showed issues that other doctors were saying were causing certain things and all that. She had actually made a recommendation for a sports psychologist or somebody that had a background in sports to more discuss the issues that I was having, and started to talk about origins of pain being more emotionally rooted and stress rooted. And I had never, that was a completely foreign concept. The first time she said that, I had never heard of that before. And so to talk to somebody that has a background in this kind of stuff is very, it's exciting for me. So I'm excited to talk to you.
Yeah, same. Yeah, again, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So give me some background, I guess. How, and maybe when you were an 18-year-old kid, you thought, hey, this is what I'm going to be doing down the road. But give me some background on how you got into this specifically.
Yeah, at 18, I definitely was not thinking that. So I'm 34. So when I was competing, whatever 34 minus 18 was, And, you know, I wasn't even aware that there was such a thing as sport psychology.
Okay.
So I learned that in grad school, and one of the things that got me into it was looking back at my 18-year-old self and, you know, realizing that there was more room for me to get some support and for at least somebody to kind of point me in the right direction. So I see my work in this field as giving back, and hopefully I can give something to the audience on this podcast that stays with you as you go through your own recovery and mental well-being, emotional well-being journey.
What sports did you play, or sport did you play?
Baseball was my main sport. That's
Okay.
where I put most of my focus. Ended up playing 2 years of college baseball at the D3 level.
Okay. Awesome. Cool. So you went to grad school for psychology, or were you there for something else?
I went for clinical psychology, so I chose to take a more generalist approach. And then, as I got further into the field, I've now been licensed, coming up on 4 years. So now I'm kind of narrowing the focus down. But yes, I went for the more general clinical psychology. All of my training, or most of my training, is with people who are dealing with moderate to severe mental illnesses.
Okay. And when you were, I guess when you were an athlete and you're going through school and you know that you want to get into psychology of some kind, what sort of, I guess, like issues or problems, like health-wise, were you facing maybe as an athlete that you think back on now and, man, it really would have been helpful if I knew 34-year-old Michael at this point in time. Like, was there anything that jumps out at you kind of looking back then, retrospectively?
So for me, luckily, I didn't have any personal experience with any season-ending, career-ending injuries. But of course, that's not always the case. So for me, it was really about managing the anxiety about getting injured and, you know, just even temporarily losing that identity as an athlete. You know, it comes with some status, some privilege. And when I was 18, you know, that was great. But yeah, it was really at that point for me personally, it was what happens if I get injured. And that stress in itself can actually make us more vulnerable to injury when we're anticipating and hoping it doesn't happen.
So expand on that a little bit, because the best example that I have, and maybe I'm just these are sort of on the peripheral of athletics, but and for athletics too. But I have a couple of instances that I think of, like I ride an electric skateboard and I ride a motorcycle, and when I do either one of those things cautiously, and the motorcycle more so like in the mountains or riding off road or doing that kind of thing. When I do those things cautiously, more things tend to go wrong. So that kind of sounds like what it is that you're talking about. Can you give me some clarity?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of it's a natural just brain process that where we put our attention. Or sometimes what we avoid attending to is actually the thing that continues to pop up. So I give the example. I'll tell my therapy clients. I'll say, you know, for the rest of the day, or when you drive home, don't look at, don't notice any Honda Accords, or, you know, notice every Honda Accord and see if you get a wider perspective. See if you can take in the other cars too. So that's how I relate just this like vigilance about injuries, this like the constant evaluation of like, how does my body feel today? You know, is it injury prone? So where we put our attention, and Eddie, is extremely important.
Meaning that if you're kind of always focused on an injury or the anticipation of such, that's sort of what you get. Meaning like expectation almost becomes reality.
Exactly. Yeah, it can turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. But this fear of becoming and taking on this label of an injured athlete. Yeah, that creates that stress that's going to tighten our bodies up and make us more susceptible.
All right, we're going to get back to this interview here with Michael in just a moment, but I want to give a shout out to Bobby Givargis at Pain Rehab Physical Therapy. Bobby is a doctor of physical therapy licensed in New Jersey. He offers one-on-one telehealth services. He has over 12 years of experience in both inpatient and outpatient rehabilitation. He completed his undergraduate degree in electrical engineering and through his own health struggles, made a radical shift from engineering into healthcare. Bobby has experience helping TMS sufferers through education, improving acute pain, and reducing fear of movement and symptoms. He understands TMS because in working with his own TMS coach, he was able to overcome chronic back pain, neck pain, sciatica, plantar fasciitis, and many other conditions. He also has a personal knowledge on how grief, parenting, and religious beliefs can all contribute to symptoms, as these are all things that he had to work on his own. If you're interested in scheduling a free 15-minute phone call and learning more, you can reach out to Bobby at painrehabpt.com or email him at bobby@painrehabpt.com. Let's get back to this interview with myself and Michael Soleil from San Diego. Are there maybe some examples? I don't need names or anything like that. Are there some examples in athletics that you can point to? Again, you don't have to give specifics on people or anything like that, but just something that we can all relate to, whether it be in football or baseball or, and just, you know, you can use generic pitcher A or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah. So, you're asking about like experiences like, of people that I know and kind of what that was like for them.
Yeah. If you're comfortable.
One example comes to my mind, immediately. So when I was starting out, he was in my class as well. You know, very sought after, highly recruited catcher. He ended up, he had an elbow injury. And there's a term called identity foreclosure that I heard specifically from Dr. Michael Gervais. He might be somebody that the audience might find useful if you have a podcast notes. He's a great person to get familiar with in the sports psychology world. But he talks about identity foreclosure, which is basically you foreclose on all other identities and sports has become your central one. So I had experiences where teammates would have a serious injury, but they still felt, because their identity was so tied to athletics, they didn't give themselves the opportunity to kind of explore world beyond athletics. So, you know, we'd have players kind of like, hey, they're sort of like pseudo coaches. Maybe they get like in a bat here and there. And then, you know, I've seen people really favor the injured area. You know, they start to take on, you know, I don't know for sure with this particular teammate and friend of mine, but even though the area was healed, the scans were all negative after a while, his brain unconsciously favored this elbow injury, and he just never could quite like find that natural slot again. And it's very sad. It was very hard to see. It was very hard to see. And you see that. And yeah, like it is natural to not want to be that person.
How would somebody unwind that? Like, say I'm the catcher in that example, and I've got the elbow injury. How do I unwind? You know, my brain is sort of locked in on this being an issue. How do you go about as a clinician? How would you go about helping me get past that? Like, what are some of the steps involved?
Very incremental improvements. So, you know, it's like fitness. You know, you don't go into the gym a couple times and your body is ready for whatever competition if you're competing for something. So really helping the athlete accept that an injury, you know, that there's a lag time, that all these little increments, you know, maybe you start throwing from 10 feet away. Just giving them hope that like this will add up over time. There is a lag. This will pay off in a couple weeks, 3, 4, you know, however many weeks down the line, and just holding that hope for them, bringing in other examples, or asking them to identify, hey, you know, has there been a baseball player, professional player who you really looked up to and you saw had to take a season off for injury? You know, what do you think that person would tell you in this situation? Or look at how they revived their career. So just keeping that hope alive. I would say those are the two main things.
Do you tend
to small incremental improvements, and then the keeping the hope, giving the examples, helping the athlete identify these internal resources that build the resilience to get back as close to they were. No, your body after an injury will never exactly, a serious injury will like feel the exact same. That's another thing. It's like your leg can be healthy and still feel different.
Is that more of a, and this might be crossing out of your wheelhouse, and if it is, that, you know, let me know, but is that more of a brain block, or is that a, like an actual, you know, it's a physical thing, like meaning like the leg is not, like I had my shoulder rebuilt in 2016, and any limitation, is that likely like a brain block, or is that likely like an anatomical block?
You know, I think I definitely can speak to kind of the brain block, as you put it. You know, so much of, you know, if we look at ourselves as like static versus somebody who is constantly changing. So I think a lot of it comes down to the mindset that I am willing to go through this process like for the sake of growth. And I think when we place the emphasis on the result, we tend to cancel out all the work and all the right actions that we took that don't necessarily guarantee an ideal expected outcome.
Yeah.
So in that term, yeah, it's really getting out of our brain's way by setting expectations for how should this happen, and just recognizing that everybody's body recovers differently. Mm-hmm. And it might be an opportunity to learn to use your body in a different or a new way, a way that you never even considered in the past because you were able-bodied or you were injury-free. So keeping options open, I think, is a great way to get beyond that block.
So a good amount of what we've chatted about so far revolves around athletes who have an injury or had an injury. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, like, are, do people come to you that are athletes that don't necessarily have like a physical issue that's popped up, but more so maybe they're just seeking a therapist, or, you know, that kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So talking about like, other issues.
Yep. Or maybe not. Yeah. Maybe not even like, yeah. Like, 'cause I'm always thinking in terms of these like physical problems for the most part. Can you talk a little bit about maybe non-physical injuries or recovery or rehab or anything like that, but more the mental side of an athlete and people that are coming to you with whatever variety of issues those might be, and they're an athlete. Like, can you comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I see is relationships. So specifically relationships with teammates, with coaches. Those relationships, really, they have a lot of potential to build us up, and they have the potential to knock us down really quickly.
Yeah.
And I forget who it was, but I saw a tweet from a reputable sports psychology practitioner who talked about how performance anxiety is. It's really well explained by social anxiety. You know, it's this fear of what are my teammates going to think if I blow this shot? How is my coach going to react if I make a mistake? So yeah, this, I thought this clinician took a really interesting take on that. That so much of this is, how is this going to, how are people going to think of me? Because sports are, athletes are more visible today than ever before. We as humans are not meant to be exposed to millions of people. You know, we're meant to live in small tribes with a handful of meaningful relationships, and the reputation stays within the tribe.
Yep.
So social anxiety is a huge aspect of something, of a reason why athletes will come in.
What's a way that, so like part of what I do, I coach young athletes. I coach young girls soccer. So U10, so they're 9, 10 year old girls. What are things that at that age, because that's sort of like, it's kind of this ripe age where, you know, they're more impressionable, but they also don't have maybe like the, like, let me give you a good example. I coached a U10 girls soccer game in the morning one day. And then the afternoon I went to my niece's U17 soccer game. And the way that even like parents and spectators act on the sidelines was quite different. And I had asked a parent, hey, like, I'm at this U10 game this morning and parents are hooting and hollering and shouting and doing all this kind of stuff, but they're not at this U17 game. And the parent had said, well, kids that are teens just have a lot more feelings and maybe more vocal with their parents about, hey, like, I'm playing a game here. Like, you got to back off, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about like the role of a coach with young kids, particularly in that younger age group, 8 or 9 or 10 or 11. How can they be helpful in the realm of, you know, so being able to assist their athletes in not having performance anxiety, or maybe lessening it, or using it as like a superpower for them? Like, what are some ways for any sort of youth coaches that may be listening? Cause there's quite a few of them I hear from them, from your perspective.
That's a great question. Kids at that age they're concrete thinkers, you know, just their brains aren't developed to the point where they have abstract thought. So if we don't have an adult or a coach in this case, or a parent, separate out the child's performance from their worth as a person, that child's going to have a tough time. Going back to that kind of concrete thinking, it's like, you know, I made a mistake, therefore, like, I am a mistake. And if we don't have a supportive present adult who has the capacity for empathy and can think back to how would I have perceived this situation when I was 9, 10, 11, I mean, without that support, without that separation between performance and character, like I said, that is absolutely going to increase a child's stress. And as you and I spoke about before, that stress, just that tension on our body that we hold when we're trying to avoid making a mistake, actually, even at a young age, I don't know child anatomy, but I would imagine that it does make kids get injured. So I can understand how I would expect that stress has some effect on injury susceptibility even for young athletes.
And you're talking about the actual like tightening of tissues when you're saying that, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. You know, one thing that we were chatting about, if you're comfortable with sharing the story or talking a little bit about it, is any sort of like issues that you've had as it relates to health that are rooted in either sport or in the anxiety of sport or the anticipation of sport, in your personal background. Do you feel comfortable telling that story?
I do. These are issues that, as you mentioned, like, seem so mysterious, right? We have, you know, anything that's, I want to be a little careful here, but things that are considered syndromes there's controversy around it. So me personally, I had digestive issues. So I get an urgent, urges to run to the bathroom. And what I learned was that it was very much connected to the stuffed down anger. And as a young athlete, there are a lot of things to be angry about. for example, just the pressure, just having some bitterness about the pressure, you know, a lot of, especially, you know, young athletes, they want to have a social life. They want to have some fun. So it's normal to get angry about feeling sort of stuck and that you're not in control of how you move through life all the time. There's also a lot of, often athletes have to be subservient to their coaches. It's getting better, but traditionally coaches take the mentality of what I say goes, feelings don't matter. Your performance is all that matters.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of things that athletes have to stuff down. And that wasn't the only source of anger that I was stuffing down, but it certainly added to it. I have no doubt about that. So the remedy was to talk about and feel that anger that for so long I considered to be unacceptable, or just an excuse, or I'm just a complainer. Oh, why can't I just stick with the program and not have any emotions towards it? So I had to sort through a lot of like, what were sources of anger that I chose to ignore, and that got converted into physical stomach problems.
How did you eventually get there? Like, I assume you're thinking that this is, you know, physically based, or maybe you're going to a doctor or whatever, and then somehow you end up pursuing this, you know, stuff down anger being a root cause. And so many people never get to that point. So how did you eventually, you know, how did you get led into that point, or how did you stumble into that, or how did that become your anecdote? How did you arrive there?
Mm-hmm. It started with education. So I know that you've interviewed my fiance, Julie Markowitz, mm-hmm. who's a fantastic clinician.
Yeah.
She has lived and educational experience with TMS and chronic pain issues related to trauma. So for me specifically, she actually, as you mentioned him earlier, Jim Prusak, who originally, as far as I recall, was trained as a physical therapist, if
yep.
I'm not mistaken.
Yep,
you
that's
may
right.
Better. So I saw him after reading John Sarno's book on TMS, The Divided Mind. Going to him, I actually only saw him one time, and it was so impactful just to hear him say, yeah, I think this is TMS related. It's not the food. You know, for years I was looking at, you know, what is it about my nutrition? What can I cut out? You know, I did food allergy tests, like just trying to find an answer. And Jim just giving me some insight was so helpful. You know, it's like an athlete with an injury going to a doctor. It really matters. It helps to know whether it's a sprain or it's a fracture.
Yep.
That sets your expectations. That sets the treatment program. So once I just had that reassurance and I was able to return to this mantra, it's not the food. Deep breath, it's not the food. And then coupling that with my own psychotherapy that really was focused on getting back in touch and learning that I don't have to be afraid of this anger and that there is a reason for this. And I need to change my relationship with it. I don't have to have less of it or none of it. I just need to change my relationship with it. And that made so much of the difference.
How long did you find after, you know, after that meeting or after that realization that, hey, things really did start to change for you in the way that you felt? And by felt, I mean like physical symptom felt.
Mm-hmm. I would say within 6 months.
That's awesome.
6 months to a year. Yeah.
Are there
really
I was just going to say, are there, like, what were some of the things? Was it just a realization, or were there types of exercises? And by exercises, I mean, you know, journaling is often talked about, but other things mm-hmm. that are kind of in that peripheral, were there things that you did that helped aid, or homework maybe, is maybe a better way of putting it, for that in particular?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the really interesting things that Jim asked me was, do you get relief after, you know, running to the bathroom? I know that might be TMI, but he asked me, do you get relief? And my answer was absolutely yes. So just that recognition that, like, I don't have to get relief by a physical, like, release. So it really brought me back to the importance of breathing and just identifying, naming the emotion. That's so important. Naming the emotion allows you to understand how to manage it. And the breath is so important. The breath, just, you know, going back to the tissue, just getting into doing some deep breathing will relieve some of that tension on the tissue. So,
is there, when you work with, you know, you work with an athlete, or you work with somebody struggling with something, and you've concluded that, hey, like, they really could be in more use of my services as opposed to a, you know, like a medical doctor. Are there certain things that you prescribe athletes to do? I mean, there's a, you know, there's awareness, you talked about breathing. I mentioned journaling earlier. Like, what are some of the tools in your toolkit that you prescribe out there or recommend to people to do if they're having issues? And these could be physical symptom problems, or these could be, you know, performance anxiety or anxiety and depression. Like, mention some of the tools that you might have in your toolkit for that.
Well, typically, athletes and other performers who are having chronic pain issues, a therapist's office is their last stop, typically. So they typically come to us, or me, and, you know, in this case, after they've been through just a slew of doctors, the frustration, and then they get desperate. So a couple of the things that I will, so there's an interesting, and tell me maybe if you've experienced this, but when you actually mindfully sit down and just observe the areas of pain in your body, actually, like, the attention and the breathing through it, and the really the understanding of it, the non-avoidance of it, you'll actually notice that the pain tends to dissolve a little bit. Have you happened to try that, just like the mindfully sitting with pain and noticing the tension?
I have. The example I've given when I talk about that, doing that on this podcast, one of my favorite movies, probably number two on my list, is based in Santa Monica. I don't know if it was actually filmed there, but Point Break, the one from the early 90s. The example that I give is Bodhi at the end of the movie. I don't know if you've seen it, looking at the 50-year storm. He's down in Bells Beach, Australia, and he's watching these massive waves. And I say that so often, if we have let's say that my ankle is killing me, or my shoulder hurts, or whatever, that we go throughout our day trying to kind of avoid feeling that because it hurts, like the natural instinct. So maybe we pop a pill, or maybe we just try not to think about it, trying. And that, to me, almost is like setting off the nervous system on alarm. Like, hey, I'm trying to not pay attention to this thing. By proxy, then all I'm doing is making it hurt more. But if I can mm-hmm. sit there and stare at the wave and let the wave crash into me, I'm going to be standing on the other side. And I do quite a bit of, like, somatic work, like just like somatic tracking or somatic experiencing or whatever we want to call it. Mm-hmm. And if awesome. I'm having an issue and I'm sitting there bringing the awareness to it, it might get worse for a minute or two, but then oftentimes dissolves, and in some cases is just completely gone not long after. And it wasn't always that way, but that's become my number one tool in the toolkit, is observing and sitting with, and then letting it do its thing, and then it's gone.
That's awesome. And what a great recognition on your part too. Just noticing the change in the sensation of the pain, right? And just and expecting that, yeah, when we bring our focus to it initially, as you said, like the pain might increase. It might feel more intense. But giving yourself that opportunity to just break through that initial discomfort when you step into an uncomfortable situation. You know, it's very uncomfortable for a lot of people, especially with a history of trauma, to get out of their heads and drop down into their body. But really that's where all the signals, that's where we understand emotion. And then, of course, as you said earlier, pain itself is experienced in the brain, and there is a level of subjectivity to that.
Yeah, and
sitting with it, you know, anything that becomes more familiar to us becomes a little less scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually, I hadn't even thought of that, but yeah, the fear of the unknown portion of it, and having no expectation or not knowing what to expect, like, totally makes sense. I actually think a lot about, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Howard Schubiner, but he does a ton of work. He's probably, I don't know, maybe the top doctor in the field out there for TMS at this point. But I had him on a few years ago, and something that he had talked about was the ways of, like, where, because not everybody has access to a TMS doctor that can definitively say, or say with quite a bit of certainty, that, hey, the problem that you have is a mind-body issue. So he was giving suggestions to listeners on what they could do. And he had said, you have a injury to, you know, whatever it is, and you've ruled out that it's not a fracture or that there's not a tumor in there or something like that. And if your symptoms wax and wane, if they sometimes are a little worse, sometimes they're a little better, things like that, like, that's kind of where you can sort of take the detective hat off, the case is closed, and you can say with a good amount of confidence that it's a TMS thing. And I think about that quote when I'm doing somatic work, because if I'm just sitting there and it's my ankle and I'm sitting there through the pain of my ankle and then it just starts to get worse, like, I didn't do anything. So it has to be brain driven, because I'm observing this thing and this thing is starting to hurt more. And then regardless of how much that pain gets amped up, I know if I can just sit there and allow myself to feel it, that it's going to dissipate and then probably eventually go away. And it happens 10 out of 10 times is the case, because I've been an athlete since I was a teenager, but doing Olympic style weightlifting and powerlifting and CrossFit competing for now the last 11 or 12 years, I've had exposure to a lot of injuries. And in the post world of me reading Sarno's book and doing this podcast and all that kind of stuff, the constant injuries that I was having for so many years with elbows and shoulders and biceps and knees and things like that, they just don't tend to happen anymore. And I think it's because I've sort of recognized that, hey, like, an injury, like an actual, like in a tendonitis injury or a lot of these joint type issues that might happen in a sport like that, the body is so good at healing. And so I know that that's another thing that Schubiner had said, is he was saying, you know, soft tissue injuries oftentimes they're going to incrementally feel better each day, but then within a week or a couple of weeks, those issues will have cleared itself up. So if you have, you know, tendonitis in your elbow or your wrist or whatever that is lasting weeks or months or years or whatever, that something else is most likely going on.
Yeah. Is this getting worse? Like, will this get worse? I think it goes with emotions too, where, you know, I'll have, a therapy client talk to, you know, I'll ask them, like, what is it about anger that you're afraid of? Or what is it about feeling sadness that you're might be afraid of? And often the answer is that it'll be permanent. Like, if I acknowledge it, it will be real. Mm-hmm. And if it's real and I can feel it, then this is bound to just just be an issue.
Yep.
You know, humans naturally aren't great at predicting the future. Mm-hmm. We don't have that capability. So yeah, the sphere of like, if I recognize it and if I acknowledge it, it's going to make it more real. And if it's, and I can't handle the realness of it, that makes us susceptible for that pain to get relocated into the body. You know, it's often easier to, let's say, tell your coach, you know, I'm really, you know, my, as you said, like tendonitis, my arm is really hurting today versus like, hey, like, I'm just really anxious. Like, I don't think my body is ready to compete at the level that you're demanding me and my teammates compete at. It's much easier to say I'm physically hurt than I'm having some mental suffering around this.
Do you think that, so this just came to me, because I feel like culture in general is sort of changing, like the paradigm is shifting a little bit, at least to me. And again, it could be this might just go back to the Honda Accord analogy where I'm looking for it. And so now it's just sort of there. But do you see, because when you're talking about that, saying it's easier for me to say I have a physical injury than it is for me to say that I'm emotionally struggling with something, the picture I get in my head is a athlete sitting in a locker room before the game's supposed to happen or practice or whatever, and they have this conversation that they should have with their coach probably, but they're scared to because of how the coach could respond or bench them or like whatever. Just right. Generally speaking, and again, like, you know, you're 34, you like, we're not old guys. I'm 37. We're not in our 60s. Mm-hmm. We don't have a 20, 30, 40 years of experience in this stuff. But have you seen any sort of a shift of maybe even where it was like 10, 12 years ago to where like coaches are just more cognizant of this mind body connection thing? Because I'll be honest, like, I hadn't heard about sports psychology or psychologists that work in sport specifically since Dr. Harmon said that. And that was only in 2017. So that was, you know, it was 6.5 years ago. So it's not like I had heard of it all that long ago.
Right. Right. So I want to make sure I just clarify the question that you'd like me to answer.
Yeah. So just wondering if there's any sort of a difference now, like if an athlete went to a coach 20 years ago and said, hey, I'm struggling with something emotionally, so I can't play today. Mm-hmm. We kind of saw this with Simone Biles a couple of years ago, where she was having some performance anxiety issues. And there were a lot of people that spoke up and said, yes, I understand. I totally get it. But then there were also a lot of people chattering that, you know, said, oh, like, quit being a wimp and all that kind of stuff. Those are the two attitudes I'm talking about. Has that changed in the last few years as you have observed it? Like, is that tide changing and shifting, particularly in coaching, if you even have exposure to know that or have seen that?
Gradually.
Okay.
Gradually, but yes, it's moving in that direction. One example you might have come across is the Positive Coaching Alliance.
No, I haven't.
So there, yeah, people are talking about it more. And I think, you know, mental health practitioners who work in sport also have the potential to make a huge impact in terms of helping athletes communicate to their coaches and coaching the coaches on how to manage emotional issues and getting away from this conditioning that having emotions while playing sport is a sign of weakness. So I think it is moving in that direction.
Good.
It's sort of how coaches used to do all the strength and conditioning. And then they brought in strength and conditioning coaches. And now a lot of the strength and conditioning and some of the physical therapists actually end up doing some of that emotional counseling with the athletes. So it's moving towards, you know, there's this third wave where your performance coaches, mental health professionals are going to be integrated into these organizations, just like the physical strength and conditioning. I think it's just, eventually it's going to be a seamless thing. In fact, I even, this was a couple of years ago, but I believe he's the, I don't know if he still is, but he's the coach at, the baseball coach at University of Arizona. He would have entire practices where they didn't pick up any piece of equipment. It was all about the mental training and building that mental fortitude to get through adversity.
Is it?
We need more of that, though. We need more of that.
Does that, you know, a session like that, and I'm assuming you weren't there, but a session like that, is that more rely around, is it visualization? Is it positive thinking? Is it, or is it more understanding that athletes struggle with certain things and that's okay? Like what's sort of the, usually the messaging if that were to be a session for a team?
That's a great question. You know, a lot of the performance side of sport and something that coaches are qualified to talk about is that present moment awareness. You know, I often make references to baseball because I know it well. You can't get that last pitch back.
Yep.
You cannot take anything back. And one of the things that I've seen in interviews with professional players, they talk about training to be really good at forgetting. Short-term memory. Other people talk about phrase it as failing forward. So, and then in terms of, and then, so Eddie, there's a little bit of a divide also where the licensed practitioners will handle more of the emotional side of things. They'll work with athletes about off field issues, things like that. So, but it's moving towards the mental skills coaches and the mental health professionals out there, really giving the coaches the tools. And, you know, coaches also need to know that when their athletes make mistakes on the field, it is not a reflection of their worth as a person or a coach. So, you know, understanding that there is so much out of our control. We can take right action and get an unfavorable result.
There's an article
really focusing on what can you control.
There's an article there's an article you're making me think of that I actually just sent you in chat, and I would encourage you to click it. Click it and bookmark it. You don't have to read it now, but there is a I'm a Mariners season ticket holder, and
nice.
Jared Kelnick, who we just traded to the Braves last Sunday, and I couldn't have been more heartbroken, nor could plenty of fans here in the area that we traded him to the Braves for basically a hot dog and a handshake. And there was a story. We've had him in our system for 3 or 4 years, meaning Jared Kelnick in the Mariners system. And he was kind of supposed to be, him and Julio Rodriguez were supposed to be the centerpieces of the rise and the rebuild of this team that hadn't been to the playoffs since 2001. And he would show these like glimpses of brilliance in the 2021 season, the 2022 season. But still, like he kept getting relegated down to AAA, and a lot of it, you just like, you'd watch him, like he'd strike out, he'd go 0 for 8, 0 for 9, whatever. And you'd see him slamming his bat down. You'd see him screaming at himself. Like it looked like he was taking it so, like he was taking it very hard on himself. And then the last year, 2023 season opened up, and a month into the season, and Kelnick's the best hitter in baseball, and it's by a mile. He's leading baseball in home runs. He's hitting the furthest home run ever hit at Wrigley Field. Like, I think it was a 492-foot home run to dead center field. Like, this stuff that I think he went to Driveline and did some of the things that, like, physically up his game. But this article written by The Athletic was entirely about this adjustment that he had been making and seeing, like, a sports psychologist. That was sort of the turnaround that he attributed that to. What was interesting is that he started to struggle again. So we're talking about he was the best hitter in baseball till about mid-May, so almost 2 months. Then he started struggling. He struggled for 3 or 4 weeks. He struck out, and one thing we started seeing in him having a much better start to the season is when he would strike out, he wouldn't have these fits where he would start screaming after the at-bat as he's walking back to the dugout. It was just, I did it, and this was – you know, this was it and I'll try better next time. And he wouldn't, you can't get that last pitch back or whatever the term was. It seemed like he was adopting that, like that was part of the thought. And then he'd been struggling for 3 or 4 weeks. Strike goes 0 for 4 for the day, walks into the clubhouse, kicks a cooler, breaks his foot. He's out for 3 months. So it almost seemed like all that work he had done had almost unwound, and he was back with, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks left in the season in September. And then we traded him, and I'm sure he's going to go on and be the NL MVP next year with Atlanta, because that's just sort of how it happens. But you should check out that article. It's entirely stuff about the things that you're talking about. And I think you'd find it really interesting.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. I definitely look forward to reading it. And it's a great example of the mental physical interaction, because throughout the season, I doubt that his name's Jared, right?
Jared.
I doubt that Jared lost any of his physical abilities. He didn't become less talented in a couple of weeks or after one strikeout. So we have to look at the conditions. You know, what kind of support does this player need? Mm-hmm. What might be going on that's getting in the way of him performing at his best? A lot of mental skills coaches and psychologists and other licensed people in the field talk about just getting out of your own way and letting your body perform naturally.
Yep.
That might have been what was. Oh, and the conditions. Coming back to the conditions, you know, I give a metaphor to clients about a plant. If the plant's not growing, we don't yell at the plant and ask, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you growing as well as you did last year?
Yep.
You know, oh, you were so beautiful and like you had all these beautiful flowers. We don't do that, right? We change the conditions. We assess what is helping this plant thrive, what helped the plant thrive last year, what's different this year. How do we give it the resources to give it the potential to thrive again? Again, not like guaranteeing, but how do we set the environment for success?
That's a crazy way to, not a crazy way in a bad way, a crazy way in a good way. It never occurred to me, but you're right. We have these sort of like breakdowns or whatever with inanimate objects. And I feel like we do always default to the surroundings and what the environment and what's around them. But when it comes to people, which are not inanimate objects, it's what's wrong with the person. Does that make sense?
Right. Yes. Great. Yeah, absolutely.
That's really interesting. Okay. That's something to chew on. Just that. It's something to chew on.
Sure. Yeah. Cool.
Michael, anything else? We're wrapping here. I'm a few minutes over what I intended to. So thanks for hanging out, but anything else that's top of mind or that's come to mind before we wrap up?
The one word that comes to mind, Eddie, is patience. We have to find a way to be patient with ourselves when we're dealing with chronic pain issues, performance issues. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to go towards full-on self-love, self-compassion. Like it is totally, it's helpful to start with, like, how can I take a neutral stance towards myself? Like, can I be okay with how I'm existing in this present moment? Because it's often that gap between what's going on in reality and what we think ideally should be happening. The degree of suffering happens in how close those two are together.
Yep.
So accept the reality, be as patient as possible, and trust yourself.
That's good advice. Michael, thanks so much for being here. It's been great talking to you. Thanks. Thanks for your work. And I could talk about baseball and the psychology behind it all day. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Take care, Michael.
You too.